Welcome to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Catherine Ident in for Steve Junker, and this is our weekly News Roundup, where we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times newsroom is Cindy McCormick. Also joining us this hour will be George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner, and Louisa Hufstader from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll also check in with Jack Spillane from the Standard Times, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Mike Dean, WCAI Statehouse reporter, and WCAI producer Sam Houghton. But first, I want to talk with Cindy McCormick, who again joins us from the Cape Cod Times newsroom. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
Cindy, I want to first talk about a story in today's paper, and that's about the bridges. The state's congressional delegation was sharply critical of news that the Trump administration budget does not include funds to build two new bridges over the Cape Cod Canal.
Yeah, neither does the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers fiscal 2020 work plan.
Yeah. Both
the president's budget and the Corps of Engineers work plan were released this week. Yeah, and this prompted the Massachusetts delegation, the Democrats, to send a strongly worded letter to Washington calling the mission inexplicable and expressing deep disappointment.
Mm. And now let's talk a little bit about what the plan is. The Army Corps is working on a plan that they say is still going through the approval process, which I understand is why the Army Corps didn't include the funding. But state legislators are saying that this is a congressional mandate or congressional will, and the Trump administration is ignoring them.
Yeah, the Army Corps, you know, has already said that they really see that it's important to replace the bridges rather than to keep repairing them, and that's their plan. However, they say they are working on a final report on this that has not been submitted yet. And the Army Corps is the federal agency that owns and maintains the bridges, and they determined that the $1.5 million estimated to replace them would be more cost-effective than repairing them, and work could begin as early as 2025. And they expect that final report will be submitted to headquarters this month, and they're saying until they have an approved report, they can't go ahead with the budgeting process. However, Massachusetts Democrats are saying that, well, we wanted to get an early start on this and make sure this will cut costs. We want to get something in place right away.
Right. They're saying
they call it a significant down payment and a responsible long-term investment.
Right. And they really did have some sharp language calling it inexplicable, saying they were very disappointed. And the budget, though, did include $12 million, and that's just for repairs, right, on the current bridges as we have.
Yeah, that's $12 million for the Cape Cod Canal Federal Navigation Project. And the president's budget also allows $12 million for the additional $12 million for ongoing operations and maintenance of the canal. But yeah, you talked about sharply worded letter. They said that this is they're concerned that this decision reflects a failure to understand the urgency of the situation for the Cape and Islands. And residents of this region cannot wait multiple years for the project to begin. They said that the Bourne and Sagamore bridges are not only vital links to the beating heart of the Massachusetts tourism economy, but critical evacuation routes in the event of an emergency.
I know. It's like, can we get the president to come down for a little long weekend and have him travel over those bridges and see what it's like, right?
Right. Congressman Keating is saying that this is just gutting the Army Corps' budget, that the president's administration has gutted the Army Corps' budget for the second year in a row.
Right.
And like you said, strong language, and said that this is a continued refusal to fund vital infrastructure projects.
Well, and of course, I don't doubt that there'll still be some strong advocacy and support of replacing these bridges, as we've had this discussion for many years now. And this story even quotes Wendy Northcross as well and her reaction to this news.
Yeah, she said we're in it for the long haul, and she says it's not going to be a simple task, and they knew that, but she said we will prevail eventually. The federal government owns the bridges, and they have a responsibility, she said, to help us figure this out.
And another story kind of with federal implications, but right here on the local level, is about the fishing industry. And the Conservation Law Foundation this week, they're based in Boston and they're an environmental nonprofit, asked the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to ban fishing for Atlantic cod, at least until regulators work out a new management plan. They're saying that the species is completely collapsed and not rebounding.
Right. And this petition was filed on Thursday, and it invokes the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And that's a law governing federal fisheries. And the first article of the act stipulates that overfishing must end immediately, that overfishing must end immediately, and fish stocks should be rebuilt as soon as possible if these stocks reach a critical state of lowness, reach a critical state. And this petition was filed with the NOAA regional offices in Gloucester and in Washington, D.C., with U.S. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross.
Right.
Now,
And I was going to say, just for context on this, think about, we talk about the cod fishery and a lot of different fisheries all the time in the news, both on the paper and here on WCAI. But in the 1800s, fishermen were landing 45,000 metric tons of Georgia's bank cod. And it's a fraction of that now, just both the landings and the population.
Yeah, it was more than, between the Gulf of Maine and Georgia's Bank was more than 60,000 metric tons. Now, in the 1980s and 90s, when there's like more efficient and powerful vessels, they landed about 80,000 metric tons. But that was, over what we would call overfishing nowadays. Mm-hmm. And now it's only at, 500 metric tons. And it's gone way, way down in 600 metric tons around there.
Right.
So we're talking about a vastly decreased population of cod. And it just does not seem to be rebounding like other species have been, haddock and scallops. Scallops have come back. Cod has not come back, and they're at historically low populations right now,
right.
both in the Gulf of Maine, and scientists believe that the Georgia's Bank stock is also, historically low.
Right, two distinct stocks, but both cod. They also requested 100% observer coverage, and that's putting monitors on fishing boats. They're saying that might help with issues such as bycatch.
Right, and that's another thing they're asking, not only for the prohibition on the fishing of cod commercially and for recreationally, but also they're saying that, we want to limit the bycatch of cod that's accidentally caught when they're fishing for other species like haddock. And another thing is that there's not a lot of spawning stock for the cod. I mean, these are historically low levels. I mean, the Gulf of Maine stock is 6 to 9% of what's considered healthy and sustainable. Georgia's Bank stock is only about 7% of the spawning stock goal. And NOAA is actually estimating that there is 0 to 1% chance that the Gulf of Maine stock will reach a 10-year rebuild goal. And this is like the second failed 10-year project to rebuild the cod stock. So cod is in trouble.
Mm.
And of course, we're named after Cape Cod. I mean, this is Cape Cod. This is
right. This is no small thing.
Right.
No, and it's a symbol at the State House too, the sacred cod. We were talking about that this week. Well, and to be fair to regulators, they have of course been working on this and trying to figure out a solution. And the New England Fisheries Management Council does have some regulations that they are kind of finishing up to try to get ahead of this.
Yeah, a council representative said that council members and scientists agree that both of the cod stocks in these two different areas are in very bad shape, but the representative said that the council and NOAA have many projects underway that will lead to greater accountability for fishermen and better estimates of the cod populations, and they want to try that first before going for the prohibition.
All right. I want to switch now to another story. It's gruesome. We may not want to go into all of the details here. You can certainly read them in the paper, but it's an animal abuse case that really rocked the region when someone broke into some stables in Harwich last weekend and impaled a pitchfork handle into a pony and also set loose some other horses.
Yeah, this happened at CB Equestrian. Someone released four horses, and one of them was actually a pony, a 7.5-year-old Welsh pony, considered very gentle, friendly pony, name is Scotty, and used a pitchfork, the handle of a broken pitchfork on the pony so that one end was coming out of the abdomen. Horrifying situation found in the morning. Veterinarian rushed to the scene. The pitchfork was removed. The animal was taken to Rhode Island, transported to an animal hospital in Rhode Island. And fortunately, the pitchfork handle did not hit any major organs, and the pony is recovering. The nice thing about this has been that, besides the fact that the pony is recovering, is that there's been a huge amount of public response. I mean, they were asking, GoFundMe was set up for the pony's recovery and also for security now at the farm. And I checked yesterday afternoon, it had been the goal was 25,000. It had already reached over 41,000.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's
people
impressive.
Are really responding to this.
Yeah.
And this pony is he's being trained as a show pony, especially for children learning dressage. And the Harwich police are asking anyone who lives in that around Derby Lane has a surveillance camera at their property to contact police.
That's right. They are looking for who did this and to get this matter taken care of. I want to switch over now to some potential town meeting business, and that will be in Yarmouth in Springtown Meeting. Voters are going to be asked to take a look at a number of items on the warrant to address sewering. The town wants to get going with the first phase of the sewer project for about $127 million, but officials are devising ways, they hope, to not go right into the pockets of taxpayers in the form of a tax increase.
Yeah, Yarmouth Assistant Town Administrator Rich Benvenue and the town's Water Resource Advisory Council have a plan. They want to tap the town's ongoing revenue sources and also user-generated amounts as a way to pay for the $127 million first phase. And this is for that regional wastewater treatment plant. And yeah, they hope to do that without that first phase without raising taxes.
Right. And this is a really multi-pronged plan that they have. And I think many towns on the Cape are doing similar things. There's no one way to address this massive problem that is, you know, regionally billions of dollars will need to be spent to deal with nitrogen loading. The town also is working on an agreement, which I think voters will be asked to approve, with the towns of Dennis and Harwich. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah. With Springtown meetings coming up, Yarmouth, Dennis, and Harwich voters will be asked to approve a three-town agreement for a regionalized treatment plant, and that will be called. This is the so-called DHY Clean Waters Community Partnership. It'll be managed by a seven-member commission. There'll be three representatives from Yarmouth, two from Dennis, and two from Harwich, and the wastewater treatment plant will be in Dennis. Mm. That's the plan,
right? And it's critical from town officials' perspective that meeting voters not only in Yarmouth, but in the other two towns, say yes to this, because that could maybe open up funding in the form of interest-free loans.
Yes, they said that if you have this regional approach, they're much they go to the head of the line as far as 0% interest rates, and that will save a lot of money. If paying no interest could save the town of Yarmouth $20 million versus a 1% interest rate over the first 15 years of the loan, and could save $40 million versus a 2% interest rate. So that's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. It really is, especially when you think about this first phase is $127 million. But the town plans some significant sewering, at least half or maybe even more than half of the town, over the next few decades. This is going to be a long project.
This is the long haul. Yarmouth expects to install sewer lines in 50 to 60% of the town, and that's over the next 40 years. But right now, they're focusing on phase one. Mm. And it's going to start with 2 years of design and engineering, followed by 3 years of construction and connection.
All right. And finally, Cindy, I wanted to take a look at a story that you did this week, and it's about nursing homes and the role that they're starting to take in dealing with the opioid crisis.
Yeah, well, Cape Cod Regency Rehabilitation and Health Center in Centerville is one of a growing number of nursing homes that will take patients who have opioid use disorder. Now, Cape Regency is owned by Athena Healthcare Systems, which in September reached an agreement with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston. The U.S. Attorney's Office said Athena had violated the Americans with Disabilities Act by refusing to admit patients treated for opioid use disorder on medication-assisted treatment. And Athena agreed to adopt a non-discrimination policy and pay a civil penalty of $10,000, and now they have John Seaman is a licensed substance abuse counselor, and he divides his time between Cape Regency and the other home on the Cape owned by Athena, which is Cape Heritage. Athena owns more than a dozen nursing homes in Massachusetts.
Mm. And what I think was interesting about your story, because it's not just about Athena, it's kind of, you use them as an example because they're local, but this is kind of a bigger problem because there's some liability here for nursing homes. There's federal regulations that kind of put them in a little bit of a bind.
Yeah, and Athena is an example because it participated in the settlement. Someone made a complaint, but this is a sign to other nursing homes that, you know, that they may have to follow suit. They may have to follow in Athena's footsteps. But one of the difficult things is patients do need transportation. They need transportation to their clinics where they're getting their, you know, Suboxone. They need management of the Suboxone. There needs to be security. You have to hire the additional counselors, and right now that's not covered by MassHealth. The extra things that surround it. The activities are very important, you know, engaging people in leisure activities, and nursing homes already do that to some extent, but it's particularly important for patients with opioid use disorder. So these are all things that I talked to Tara Gregorio. She's from Massachusetts Senior Care, and she said that the MassHealth system really needs to be overhauled to pay for this. The reimbursement system really needs to be overhauled to pay for all of this.
It really goes to show you how with something like an epidemic with the opioid crisis, how it kind of comes up and envelops us kind of culturally and economically, and then the gears can be a little bit slow in turning to be able to respond, and you know, now nursing homes are trying to kind of grapple with that and get ahead of that.
Right, because people with opioid use disorder also, you know, they get in two car crashes and need rehabilitation like everyone else. The young woman I spoke to, a 35-year-old woman, has multiple sclerosis and another central nervous system disorder, and she ended up in the nursing home after falling off her bed, sliding off her bed and hitting her head. She was trying to take care of herself in a rental room in Dennis. Ended up in the hospital, ended up in the nursing home, ended up in Regency, where she said that there, she said that the care there she's getting is terrific.
Right, and she really is a good example of how multiple agencies need to be involved in helping somebody overcome this and learn to and have the supports they need to live a healthy life.
That's right. And the people at Regency said that they are inspired by her because she's been, you know, she's persisted through all this, and this is why they want to help patients like her.
Well, Cindy, thanks for that story. And thanks for coming on with us this week on the News Roundup to tell us about some of the top stories that the paper has covered in the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, have a great weekend.
You too.
That's Cindy McCormick. And I want to turn now to some stories about the wind industry. And joining me on the phone from the Standard Times is Jack Spillane. Good morning, Jack.
Hi, Catherine.
Thanks for joining us this morning. So some big news, kind of a two-pronged story. It involved both Mayflower Wind and Vineyard Wind. First, let's talk about Mayflower Wind coming out with a proposed rate that is lower than what Vineyard Wind, which is a little bit farther along in the process, has agreed to.
Yes, people have been encouraged by that because the whole thing with wind is whether they can supply it at an affordable enough rate that it's competitive for the long run. As you probably know, there's been a lot of technology advances in the wind industry, even since Vineyard Wind won the state's first offshore bid. So they, Mayflower came in with a even lower rate, and the state predicts that that will make it more affordable, and that long-term makes offshore wind much more viable, certainly far more viable than Cape Wind was 10 years ago or so.
Right. And both of these projects are pretty similar, I think, in size. And actually, when you get down to it and you look at what the savings will be and what the rates are, you're talking about like fractions of pennies. But when you think about it on a large scale, it does add up.
Yes, it's fractions of, pennies on a small unit. I forget what the kilowatt unit is, but it's when you get your whole bill for how much you've used over a month that it will make a difference.
Mm. And Mayflower Wind has said that it will provide 10,000 jobs around the region and eliminate nearly 2 million metric tons of carbon dioxide. Like they say, that's the equivalent of taking 350 vehicles off the road. But I want to use that to kind of pivot now to Vineyard Wind. And, you know, there's plans to get that up and running, but Mayflower Wind may kind of have this problem because the federal government is kind of slowing down the permit process. And so now Vineyard Wind's construction timeline is being pushed.
Yes, Vineyard Wind's timeline has been pushed back a couple times. The latest was that they had hoped to get the permit by September, but now the Trump administration, it's actually NOAA, has announced that it will be December, but before it's ready. So it's going to push back the time when they feel that they can have the turbines up and running till past 2022. Mm. They originally thought that they would be ready to be selling power by then, but it's going to be a little bit delayed.
Yeah, and that construction timeline is delayed. That will have been about a year, so because they were supposed to break ground last year at this point. So this is pretty significant.
And those are not small things because they have developed their business plan with expectations as to when they could begin to sell power, yeah. Expectations as to how much the deals they could broker with the federal government are for tax write-offs and things like that. So every time you push it back, the worry is that it could become less viable for the companies that have won these bids.
Right. I thought it was important, though, to note that the story in the Standard Times makes note of the fact that analysts say that, you know, wind is coming no matter what. And we certainly are keeping an eye on these individual projects. But, you know, international companies with deep pockets now have their eye on this, you know, nascent industry here in the U.S. And, you know, we're going to see wind even if it's just a little slower in coming.
I guess that is true. I know that there are some significant concerns in New Bedford by fishermen that the location of the turbines could adversely affect their industry. I'm sure that's the same for Cape fishermen. And there was some talk, at least in this city, that the federal government is interested that offshore oil exploration, which is, depending on which administration is in power, is still on the table. So we'll see. The federal government basically is saying that they want to study this further because it's a large industry and it's going to affect the offshore for the foreseeable future.
Mm. Another story in New Bedford this week that's garnered some attention, and that is to do with how the fire department is managing its stations. There's been some controversy over a policy whereby the city or the fire department closes one station at a time on a rotating basis due to staffing and staffing needs. And the fire chief said, okay, we will end that policy, but we're going to close a station. And there's been a little bit of a backlash about that.
Yes, the firefighters union has staged a protest this week and plans another one over the weekend, objecting to the closure of Engine 11, which is located on the peninsula in the south end of New Bedford. There was construction underway to build a replacement station that will cover two stations in the south end, but the union and its supporters are objecting to the closure now of one station, which will leave that part of the city having to get the next nearest station supplying their firefighting, and permanently to reduce that fire station. The city has struggled, as a lot of post-industrial cities have struggled since the 2008 recession, with fully funding a lot of its municipal departments. And for a while, the federal government subsidized them with the SAFER grants, and those grants have begun to be less. Mm-hmm. And so the city is looking for ways to save money. They have studies that show that there are, because of advances in sprinkler systems and fire alarms, that there are less fires and that, you know, they don't need as many stations as they have in the past. Members of the public and the union have countered that, well, we don't want to be the neighborhood that has its station closed.
Right, and have that tested out. And that is Jack Spillane talking to us from the Standard Times. Jack, thanks so much for an update on both of these stories.
Glad to be of help.
Have a great weekend. I want to turn now to news from the Vineyard with George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Katie.
So, George, more bad news for the Tisbury School. An architect says the inside of the school would need to be gutted. Officials are trying to figure out if they should renovate. There's been a lot of problems.
That's right, Kitty. I wonder how we could have seen this coming. Maybe dial back a couple of years ago when a building committee went through this whole process previously and realized that this 1929 building just isn't up for
today's needs.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so much has gone wrong with this school. You know, we've talked a lot about the lead and the asbestos, but, you know, there's water infiltration through the roof of this school. The windows, there are issues with them. You know, so all of that's going to have to be replaced. On top of that, you know, the first look at it by this new architect is, you know, that it's going to be need to be gutted down to the studs.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who's ever gone through a renovation project knows that when you have to take something down to the studs like that, it costs a lot of money first to do that and then to rebuild.
Right.
And they want to add on as well. So the price tag just keeps growing and growing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, nearly to as much as what it would cost to build an entirely new building, right?
Maybe more.
Wow.
You know, the estimate a few years ago was $46 million to build a new school. And numbers are just being tossed about at this point. There's no firm estimate, but the number of $50 million has been broached. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether the taxpayers will have an appetite for that after they turn down $46 million for a brand new school and the state kicking in about $14 million for that, you know, remains to be seen. This isn't going to voters this spring. They're still working on exactly what they're going to do. But, you know, this meeting was any indication, you know, voters are going to be asked to pay some significant money to build or to renovate and add on to this school.
Mm.
And, you know, we'll have to wait and see
oh, yeah.
you know, whether
what will happen.
Agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know you'll be following that, and we'll be talking with you about it as that process progresses. Briefly, George, I want to talk about a quirky story in the paper this week that is just a lot of fun, and it's not about modern, up-to-date technology or anything like that. It's a blast from the past.
That's right. And it all comes out of a fairly boring budget review. You know, I've been in the business 33 years, and I did a quick calculation on how many of these I've sat through, and I came up with too many. But, this particular budget review was the building department in Tisbury, and they have a fairly young building commissioner there, and he found out that they were still using typewriters to do all their forms. So he's eliminated that line item out of his budget. What I found out is that there's still quite a few departments, both in Tisbury and across the island, that still use typewriters. As many as 50 of them are on the island. And there's this one gentleman, he's from off-island. He comes over twice a year and faithfully repairs the 50 typewriters on the island. So there's some interesting tidbits from him, including through the years he's gotten to meet Jim Belushi. And there's a great story. I'm not going to give it away.
That's right. I was going to say, don't give it away. You need to go and read this if you're interested in this story, because it's cute. He's a raconteur. I bet he's a lot of fun to talk to.
Yeah, I actually said to him that I would love when the next time he's over here, just come down and we'll have a cup of coffee together, because he was a hoot.
All right. And that is George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. If you want to check out that story about the typewriters, go to mvtimes.com. George, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Katie. Have a great weekend.
You too. Now on to the Outer Cape. I want to talk with Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Marianne.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for chatting with us this morning. And I want to talk about green burials. So Provincetown residents can now choose this green burial at town cemetery as when they die. Tell us what this is all about.
Well, let's see. The Cemetery Commission in Provincetown started this process maybe about a year and a half ago, where they wanted to introduce the option for green burials at the town cemetery. And so the Cemetery Commission, they studied, they talked with Public Works, Health Department, and so on, and they eventually decided to propose to the Select Board just this past Monday to reserve 30 plots for green burials there at the town cemetery. So that actually did pass.
That's great. And tell us kind of what this is all about. This has to do with not only not being embalmed, but how you're buried.
Right. Well, it kind of starts with the idea of embalming. So for a natural or green burial, you start with an unembalmed body. Mm-hmm. And I guess way back, embalming used to involve more like spices, but now preserving the body has some what are considered harmful chemical aspects to it, such as arsenic and formaldehyde. Mm-hmm. So now the town cemetery already accepted unembalmed bodies, but they still had to be in a cement-lined
vault
box.
Yep.
So now really that particular requirement for the cement-lined vault has been eliminated.
Right. And I think what's interesting is, as you mentioned, that unembalmed bodies were already allowed to be buried because it's actually not a state law. I kind of thought that you had to be for whatever reasons, but it does kind of turn, it almost appears that it's like a legacy cultural thing that we expect to happen in this modern day, but there are folks who, may not choose to do that. But of course, if you do choose to do that, do the embalming and the cement lined vault, you can still do that in Provincetown, correct?
Yes, actually one person came to the hearing with the Select Board just to make sure that she could still be embalmed and be in a, kind of a traditional, traditional vault.
Right. So. It really goes to show you how personal this decision is. And, everybody wants to have the option that works best for them.
That's true. And, the cemetery commissioner, the cemetery director in the town, I went out to visit him, and he showed me the area where the plots will be. But he was very welcoming with the idea.
Well, that's great. Well, Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner, thanks so much for talking to us about this story. If you want to read more about that, you can check that out online. Have a great weekend. So there was big news this week, and political news anyway. Those were the primaries in New Hampshire. But here in Massachusetts, state lawmakers were busy on Beacon Hill, tackling everything from mental health care parity to updating sex education laws and conducting hearings on the governor's proposed budget for the next fiscal year. I talked with WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean for the details. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
Okay, Mike, first, a big proposal in the Senate, and that was a comprehensive bill to increase access to mental health care and to enforce some laws that are already on the books that require mental health care to be treated the same as care for physical illnesses.
Yeah, this proposal, it matches a bit of what Governor Baker wants to do, but it goes a lot further. I think this is the culmination of a lot of work the Senate has been doing to take on mental health parity. It's definitely a priority of Senate President Karen Spilka that she's had for her whole career, and she actually has a very compelling personal story about her father's struggle with mental illness and how her family was affected by that. And that is kind of the point they're trying to get across, that mental health services really affects everyone. It affects families. It affects the entire society. And that's why these new policy initiatives to bring mental health in line with physical health, which really comes down to a lot of different mandates about spending and insurance and how providers deal with mental health versus physical health and primary care and things like that, bringing that to the forefront. And I say it matches Governor Baker's priorities because, of course, his big health plan this year is a holistic primary and behavioral care package that he wants to get through the House later this spring. So there is some, shared ground between the two branches and the governor here when it comes to promoting mental and behavioral health.
I want to switch over to the House. The House this week took a look at a bill that would update sex education in schools. The bill got a favorable report by the Ed Committee this week, but important to note that this is not the first time they've talked about this, and bills like this have languished in the past. Does this have a future?
There'll likely be something. I think that since it's been highlighted by the governor, by Speaker Robert DeLeo, and by President Spilka, in some way, shape, or form, it might not be this expansive plan that the Senate is doing this week, but it could be something, a portion of that plan or a portion of Baker's plan, or really where they overlap. Baker's plan has a lot to do with forcing providers to increase spending on behavioral health care by 30% over a few years' time. That's not necessarily the mandate that's in the Senate plan, but the goals are the same. So I think that when the big three, as we call them, get together, they can see what's shared, what the goals are, and come up with something that they can pass by the end of July.
And so do you think there'll be a package that's voted on before they end their session or go on break this summer?
This has been a years-long struggle. It's a great example of where the Senate and the House differ. This is a sex ed bill that would update the sex ed curriculum to be medically accurate with age-appropriate lessons about things like parenting, anatomy that isn't already covered, LGBTQ issues, abortion, queer and identity issues, things like that. Again, this is it's pretty much agreed upon by experts that the lessons would be age appropriate, and it would remain all the same kind of opt-out mechanisms that already exist in the sex ed curriculum. It would just update what the lessons are. This is, of course, proving controversial, as most anything to do with sex or sexual identity has to do on Beacon Hill. What we're seeing here is the Senate has passed this year after year after year. Only two Republicans voted against it this year out of the four in the chamber. So it has bipartisan support, but it just does not come up in the House over and over again. And that the sticking point is that a lot of moderates in the House just don't really want to have to take a vote on something like this, especially in an election year. It takes a certain amount of political courage to get this kind of thing going. And so we're seeing a stronger push than in years past, more and more sponsors. It's got almost two-thirds of the support of the House, but there are some moderate Democrat holdouts who don't want to deal with this, don't want to do this, aren't convinced that it's a good idea, and that's keeping the speaker from giving it a vote. But this year it might change.
Lawmakers also heard testimony this week on a possible ballot question that would make liquor licenses available in greater numbers to more grocery and convenience stores. And the group behind this ballot question is Cumberland Farms. That's a convenience store chain with a big presence around the state.
Yeah, if you remember, the legislature has a shot at all of the ballot questions. And in fact, in order to get to the ballot, the legislature has to essentially decline to deal with the issue and let it go forward. So if lawmakers can't come to a compromise or don't feel like it's their job or want it to go to voters, that's going to happen through this process. So they have to have a hearing and it has to go through, you know, like any other bill would. Under current law, you know, places like Cumberland Farms, convenience stores, things like that, they only have a limited number of outlets that can sell beer and wine, and it's very lucrative. Really, this comes down to money when it comes to who's selling this kind of product, obviously. You have liquor stores on one hand. You know, the package store lobby is very, very powerful on Beacon Hill, and this is why this kind of issue hasn't really gone very far in the legislature over the years. And you also have to remember that it was just about 10 years ago that voters answered a very similar question at the ballot and defeated it, expanding beer and wine sales to grocery stores and convenience stores. So this is a large company like Cumberland Farms taking another go at it, thinking maybe public opinion has changed and they can win at the ballot. And this would really change the way beer and wine are sold in Massachusetts. It would become more similar to how other states do it.
But there are some groups around the state that don't like this idea.
Yeah, of course. When I say, you know, the money issue is definitely those package store owners, that lobby, who definitely stand to lose out from a change like this. But there's also a lot of, drunk driving, opponents, things like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, different public health and safety groups, things like that, who just don't want to see alcohol more readily available than it is. There's concern about places like this not being as careful selling to underage people as a liquor store would be. And, there are concerns from a public safety matter. But when it comes down to the ads you're going to see, that's going to be the liquor store lobby versus the convenience store lobby.
And finally, House Speaker Robert DeLeo hit a milestone last weekend. He officially became the longest serving Speaker of the Massachusetts House, 11 years. How has he stayed on top for so long, Mike?
Well, there's really two reasons why. The first one is that he didn't get caught up in any of the scandals that tripped up his predecessors. All were ousted or resigned for various indiscretions and legal troubles. DeLeo had a scrape with a bit of a scandal early on in his tenure, but survived that and was not indicted or really found guilty of anything. And he has kept things clean ever since. And the other reason is that the members really like the guy. The way he runs it is criticized sometimes in that it's very top-down and very centralized, but the decisions that are made, pretty much everyone agrees that he does take the temperature of the body, and even though he takes kind of conservative steps in executing what that body wants, it is still reflective of the House of Representatives. So that is why they got rid of the term limits on the speakership to allow DeLeo to serve indefinitely. And there's pretty much every indication he's going to run for re-election and run for speaker again and remain in charge for the foreseeable future.
Speaker DeLeo on track for another record. And that is Mike Dean, WCAI State House reporter, talking to us from Boston, as he does most weeks. Mike, have a great weekend.
Great to be with you, Catherine.
I want to talk now about some news from Nantucket this week. We have Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror on the phone. Morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, I want to talk about the island's nursing home rating. Quite a jump from 1 to 3 stars. Tell us what that's about. Staffing?
It is about staffing. A federal rating in August put the quality of care level at the town-owned R Island Home nursing home at just 1 star. But good news for the facility came at the end of last month, when that rating improved to 3 stars, and Assistant Town Manager Rachel Day, who has been instrumental in overseeing the facility recently, said that that's due in large part to a full nursing staff again. She has hired 4 nurses in recent months, 2 full-time nurses, a traveling nurse, and another nurse that works as needed on a per diem basis. The facility has also hired a new interim administrator. And he works for a company that has been contracted to not only oversee the nursing home, but evaluate its operations and make recommendations for improvements. In the meantime, Day said the nursing home is going to continue finishing up some improvements to the building, some of which is a bit outdated, including the bathrooms and some closets. And in recent months, staff offices have been moved and combined to create some more room for the residents. And this all comes as a backdrop to bigger discussions about Our Island Home, which is the only municipally run nursing home left in the state.
Mm-hmm.
A town meeting warrant article would appropriate $5 million annually for operations at the nursing home, which has been running at about a $3.5 to $4 million deficit every year. And there's been a lot of discussions in recent years about potentially moving the facility or building a new facility on the current location to better serve the needs of those islanders who live there well into the future.
Yeah.
A couple years ago, a $30 million proposal to build a new one on land, different land, was shot down, and they went back to the drawing board, and that's kind of where they stand now.
That's right. Kind of an ongoing issue and a really big issue for the island, especially as it is a town-owned nursing home. Someone's leaving the island after quite a long time, 18 years. The town's transportation planner is going to Texas.
He is. Mike Burns, 18 years ago, took the job as the town's transportation planner with the Planning and Land Use Services Department. He's been working on public transportation improvements, bicycle and pedestrian access, and traffic issues for almost two decades now. But last week, he announced that he's leaving, moving down south, where he's going to be one of the principal planners for the Houston-Galveston Area Planning Council. He'll be here for about another week before he goes down there. In his two or so decades, just under two decades here, he's had some ideas that have been controversial with islanders and haven't necessarily been applauded universally, including proposals for some roundabouts at a number of Mid-Island locations, none of which have yet been approved by voters. But Select Board member Matt Fee, who's worked with Burns his entire time on the board, said that while not all of his recommendations have always been fully supported, he stressed that he's overseen far more successful transportation and traffic improvements, like a rail trail bike path along the Nantucket Harbor, than ones that haven't passed muster with the voters. And Planning Director Andrew Vorse said he's going to have pretty big shoes to fill, and residents should probably expect that transportation improvements and projects are going to slow down a little bit until that position is filled and his replacement gets up to speed.
I love how the planner said, you know, people used to accuse him of bringing off-island ideas into Nantucket. Now he's going to have the opposite when he goes to Texas, that they're going to say, hey, we're not on island time. That is Josh Balling, Managing Editor of the Nantucket Enquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I want to turn now to a story out of the Vineyard Gazette this week that takes a look at hunger on the island. And Louisa Hofstadter is on the phone with me now to talk about this story. Good morning, Louisa.
Good morning, Catherine.
Thanks for being on the line this morning. So you did a story that takes a look at the numbers at local food pantries and kind of just in general services on the island to help folks who need a little bit more when it comes in terms of food.
Yes, it all began in a formal way around 1981 with the Island Food Pantry, originally just to sort of help, you know, fishing and farming families get through a rough winter, and has grown now to, the Island Food Pantry had more than 700 visits in January, and it served more than 1,000 people, 1,026 people. That's the first time that they have cracked the 1,000 number.
Mm.
And other food agencies, of which there are quite a few around the island now, are also seeing generally increased demand, with the exception of seniors who are having a little trouble getting out and about this time of year.
Mm. And you take a look at, you know, you mentioned that, you know, the quality of food and quantity of food has improved over the years. Are they seeing more people because there are actually more programs?
I think that's a big part of it. In 2016, the leader of our local nonprofit called Island Grown Initiative made food equity on the Vineyard a real priority. Her name is Rebecca Haig, and she was looking around and thinking, why do I get all this good food and other people are getting, you know, pork and beans from a can at the food pantry, which was sort of the kind of food you would get back then. And,
mm-hmm.
and she assembled a coalition of people that's now known as the Food Equity Network, and it's a very broad-ranging coalition of houses of worship, senior services, counseling services, all kinds of groups, some just, you know, the Island Committee on Hunger is part of it, Food Pantry, of course, and many of the churches, all of the churches, really.
Mm.
And they have created this coalition that has worked really hard to make food more accessible and healthier, which generally means food people want to eat more of. That is the choice that people at the food pantry will make if they can. And so that emphasis has made food better, more appealing, particularly to families whose needs apparently have been on the rise, according to these numbers. And also, the access is easier because they no longer have to fill out any sort of form with personal information. The only question you're asked when you go to the food pantry or receive donations of food from the Serving Hands group and so forth is how many people are in your household, how many of them are under age 18, and how many are over age 65. That's it, and that makes things a lot easier. The food pantry, for the first time, has been seeing Brazilian families this winter.
Right, yes. With that lack of forms, it's kind of taking down some barriers for folks to get in there and get what they need. And, of course, much more information in this story, which you can read in the Vineyard Gazette. Louisa Hofstadter, thanks so much for talking about it.
Thank you, Catherine.
I want to turn now to another story out of Provincetown that our WCAI's own producer Sam Houghton worked on this week, and it has to do with a new piece of technology on the waterfront by McMillan Pier in Provincetown. Kind of looks like a dock, but it's not really a dock at all. Welcome this morning. Thanks for joining us, Sam.
Thank you, Katie.
So, Sam, tell us what this is. It's a wave attenuator. I have to say that kind of sounds a little bit...
It sounds like a surfing technique.
Yeah, or something. But it's not at all. And it looks like a dock, but it's not.
Right. So an attenuator works the same way a breakwater does. I spoke with Doug Belanger. He's the pier manager there. He explained that underneath the water's surface, the attenuator is made up of these big slabs of concrete, 3 or 4 feet thick from top to bottom. And they weigh a couple thousand pounds. And cement essentially acts like a shield. It blocks wave action from hitting the docks and bounces it back into the open ocean.
Right. And so the platform you're seeing on top of the surface that looks like a dock is really almost like, to make kind of a bad analogy, the tip of the iceberg in a way, right? The work is happening underneath the water.
Right, right.
So these are not commonly used around here, wave attenuators. So what prompted Provincetown to go this route?
Yeah, really it's geography. If you think of Provincetown, you think of that hook shape at the end of the Cape. And they say that these northeasterly storms kind of move up the Cape and hit that hook shape and really kind of whip waves into action and smash them into the pier. But also, you think about Provincetown Harbor, it's really wide open. And, you know, permitting a huge breakwater could be really problematic, could be expensive. And so the wave attenuator allows you to build really close to the shoreline, and it's much smaller, and it really blocks the wave action, like kind of right at the docks.
Right. And you were saying at one point, and we were talking about this, that if you think about it, the harbor's really wide, right? Like 1,000 feet wide.
Yeah,
You know, putting a breakwater would be really costly that way. So this does a lot for things closer to shore.
Right.
This, of course, so many projects on the Cape are this way. This has been in the works for a while, right?
Yeah. The town originally wanted to install something similar decades ago when they were building new docks. Landry said that the technology really wasn't what it is today. And neighbors in the area, you know, they were saying this is going to block our view of the harbor, you know, understandably. Back then, you know, these things were, it was a big fence. But Boulanger said, you know, in 2013, there was a pretty intense storm and it really smashed the docks, and it really, they needed to do something. And in 2013, right after that, they applied for a big $4 million grant, which they got to install this wave attenuator.
That's right. And fix the docks, right? Because the docks were damaged in that storm.
Yep.
And you said originally people didn't like the idea, but they've kind of come around, especially as the technology is not as in your face.
Right. It looks just like a dock, and people are seeing that this really does do a lot to protect the pier and the docks.
All right. Well, if you're down in Provincetown, check it out. That's Sam Houghton, reporter and producer here at WCAI. Sam, thanks for checking it out.
Thank you, Katie.
And I want to thank you for listening. We're out of time. I want to thank my guests as well. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner, Louisa Hofstadter from the Vineyard Gazette, Jack Spillane from the Standard Times, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Enquirer and Mirror, and Mike Dean from WCAI's State House office right up there on Beacon Hill. And I want to thank you for joining us for the Point News Roundup on WCAI.